from WXXI News. This is Connections Summer Book Week. I'm Scott Feibusch, in for Evan Dawson. Today's connection was made in the parking lot of a TV station in Hawaii more than 30 years ago, when two women met for the first time, became a couple, and eventually ended up as the lead plaintiffs in a pioneering lawsuit that helped pave the way for legal same-sex marriage. Sasha Eisenberg spent years researching the twists and turns that led from that effort in the early 90s to full nationwide approval in 2015, and he's chronicled it all in an extensive new book, The Engagement, America's Quarter-Century Struggle Over Same-Sex Marriage. He's a Washington correspondent for The Monocle, a contributor to New York Magazine, and he joins us via Skype from California. Sasha, welcome to Connections.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
So glad you could be with us. You know, it's easy to look back now, 6 years later, and see how this all ended and why it was such an important chapter to be documented in U.S. history. But you started working on this book in 2011. What made you think that far back that this was going to be something that merited a full-length book like this?
So, you know, it was over the course of that year I was working on my last book, which is about the science of political campaigns. And so I was having a lot of conversations with pollsters or people who dealt with political attitudes in some form or another. And over again, they would make a version of the same observation to me, which is that they'd never seen opinion on a single issue move as quickly as they had seen it move on same-sex marriage. And to me, as a political reporter who understood how difficult it is to persuade people and move opinions, that just struck me as this really compelling mystery that nobody had a easy answer to. And I guess that was sitting with me when, in the summer of 2011, the New York State Senate voted to pass the marriage equality bill, which Governor Cuomo then quickly signed into law. And New York became the first large state to enact marriage equality through the political process as opposed to via the courts. And it was the first time that I felt like there was only one way that this was going to end. I think that, you know, the sort of campaign for marriage equality had been really uncertain for a while. And that really seemed evidence to me that we were approaching consensus as a country on this issue. I certainly didn't expect that we are 4 years away from a Supreme Court decision that would basically end it as an open matter for political debate. But it seemed like the time had come. We'd already beginning to talk about this sort of the defining civil rights struggle of my generation, and it felt like the time had come that you could start to explain a couple things that I just didn't really know. Like, where had this issue come from, and how did it come to, in many respects, engulf our politics for so many years?
There are so many fascinating chapters. I mean, so many biographies that you tell in brief and in the course of this book. The cast of characters is phenomenal. Let's go back. Let's start in that parking lot of the PBS station in Hawaii 30-some years ago, and let's begin our cast of characters with Janora Dansell and Ninia Bear, and explain to me how this began and why you chose to start it right there.
Yeah, so, you know, this is a meet-cute story that starts a legal revolution, I guess, in storytelling terms. Janora Dansell was working she was an engineer at a local TV station. Ninia Bear was the daughter of a coworker of hers. They met. These two women fell in love pretty quickly, and we're in the summer of 1990 now. A few months later, they exchange rings and talk about making a commitment to one another. And now, you know, in the fall of 1990, that means absolutely nothing in legal terms anywhere on earth. There is nowhere that gay couples can marry. There is, you know, no active political effort or, you know, legal case underway that would change those laws. And so this is just a sort of personal gesture between them, not a sort of meaningful political or legal arrangement. But what happens a few months later is that a local activist, a guy named Bill Woods, draws them into basically a scheme of his that really is, you know, starts as a kind of petty rivalry on a gay pride planning committee in Honolulu, and then turns into a PR stunt. And this couple, which Nia and Janora had barely been together for 6 months by this point, end up being brought in with this activist, Bill Woods, into the Honolulu office of the Hawaii Public Health Department and request marriage licenses. And they get turned down with two other couples. And the state tells the health director that he was correct not to have awarded these couples marriage licenses because under state law, marriage is just between a man and a woman. And they end up a month later in the hands of a local civil rights attorney in Honolulu who, on their behalf, sues the state. And it takes 2 years, but the Hawaii Supreme Court ends up ruling on this. And to the surprise of everybody involved, becomes the first court on earth to rule that the fundamental right to marriage guaranteed by the Hawaii State Constitution could extend to same-sex couples. And this is sort of the moment where this becomes a, you know, political issue in the way we would use that term, and a viable legal objective for that other couples can actually sort of grasp and fight for on their own in court.
One of the things in reading through some of these early chapters that got my attention is just how far from unified the gay advocacy community was in terms of wanting to pursue this. You know, we look back now and we think, oh, of course, this is something that that was a goal. But for a lot of pieces of the community, this was not only not a goal, it was something that they were hesitant to even think about going after, right?
Absolutely. And so, you know, in the 1980s, right, there's not an active case underway. There's no, you know, there's not a politician in the country who's being asked his or her opinion about gay marriage. Gay rights groups are not fighting to stop gay people from marrying. They're fighting gays and lesbians on all sorts of other areas where they're trying to win citizenship, but not this one. And to the extent that there's an active debate about marriage rights anywhere in the country, it's taking place within the gay and lesbian community, and especially among lawyers and legal theorists. And they are divided in a few different directions. There is a group, primarily men, who are arguing that marriage is an essential part of full citizenship and that there's no way that gays and lesbians will ever sort of win full citizenship in the United States if they do not have the same right to establish families that straight couples have. But there's still a very strong strain within the gay and lesbian world that kind of comes out of the post-Stonewall gay liberation movement that saw this as a very assimilationist goal. And their argument was basically that gays and lesbians had succeeded in developing their own sexual values and mores, and that the whole nature of gay liberation was to define the terms of their own existence, and why would they make one of their political demands kind of, you know, as one paraphrasing one person here, basically reenacting the white picket fence suburban, you know, middle class lives of their parents. And then sort of related to that, there was a cluster of mostly lesbians. You know, to the extent anybody was doing gay family law in the 80s, it was almost entirely female lawyers representing female clients who had had children in heterosexual marriages and then had to go to court to fight for the rights to their own children. And these women, these lawyers in particular, had been shaped, had gone to college and law school during the 1960s and 70s and been shaped by sort of second wave feminist thinking about marriage. And they saw it as an institution that had been, you know, developed to subjugate women. And their view was, why would we as lesbians want to, you know, fight for inclusion in a, you know, patriarchal institution that exists to disadvantage women? And so these debates were playing out at a very abstract level throughout the 80s. And they never really reconciled themselves in any way until after this Hawaii court decision. And that's because opponents of same-sex marriage latched onto this and decided that their biggest concern about the gay rights movement is that gays and lesbians would try to get married.
So let's talk about that side of it, because you portray a lot of the characters on that side of the movement and a lot of the pieces that came together. And there's this interesting intersection that you probe between Protestant evangelicals and the Latter-day Saint Church out of Utah. Talk a little bit about how they came together in what really at the time didn't look like a particularly likely alliance.
Yeah, so the Mormon Church becomes the first institution on the mainland to sort of properly recognize the significance of this court decision in Hawaii in the spring of 1993. And there are a few reasons for that. The LDS Church had been, you know, sort of against homosexuality as a matter of doctrine going back to the 1980s, but they were particularly well networked in Hawaii because of, you know, a long history of church missionary work in the Pacific. And so there remain to this day a large landholder in Hawaii, and they decide that this court decision is a real threat to their values, both in Hawaii and on the mainland. So the LDS Church sort of goes in a couple directions. One, they have a church lawyer draft a bill that quickly passes the Utah State Legislature that becomes a model for bills elsewhere in the country that says that Utah will not recognize any marriages that are not between a man and a woman. And then the church goes and sets up a front group in Honolulu to lobby the Hawaii legislature, ultimately to pass a constitutional amendment that will take this matter out of the hands of the courts. And there, one of the things that becomes clear about the Mormon church through this example and others is how savvy they are about their political activity and how different it is from the way that other, religious denominations or individual clergy decide to get involved in politics, which is, I think the Mormons still have a very acute sense of being basically a despised minority going back to the 19th century. And so they are willing to commit tremendous resources to, political activity in states, but they also see no value in getting credit for it or being the face of it, in part because I think they recognize that if certain types of political issues are too closely associated with the Mormon church, it'll actually make them unpopular and harder to get progress on it. So they work with the Archdiocese of Honolulu, where the basic bargain is the Mormons will provide most of the money, a lot of the expertise, research, polling, stuff like that, to set up this lobbying and a public opinion campaign in Hawaii. But the Catholics will be the face of it. And that is the first real organized political effort to defeat same-sex marriage in the United States. And it takes a little while for evangelical activists on the mainland to kind of grab a hold of this issue. And the Defense of Marriage Act, which gets introduced in Congress and signed into law by Bill Clinton in 1996, is effectively, you know, is the work of evangelical Protestants primarily to take the work that the Mormons had done and expand it to the rest of the country, to write up a federal law that would, in essence, insulate other governments on the mainland, the 49 other states, and the federal government from having to recognize any gay marriages that might come out of Hawaii.
We're talking with Sasha Eisenberg, the author of The Engagement, America's Quarter Century Struggle Over Same-Sex Marriage, joining us from California. And I want to get to California next, because that is another one of the major set pieces in the book, is this battle as this turns into, you know, how many states can we go into and preempt this with referenda before the courts can take a stab at it, or before more sympathetic legislatures can take a stab at it. And of course, Proposition 8 in California becomes one of the big flashpoints of this. Talk a little bit about how that came about some of the players on both sides of that measure there, and why it passed.
Yeah, so there had been an effort for a number of years in California to amend the state constitution to ban marriage. And it only really gets enough momentum to qualify for the ballot when the California Supreme Court rules in favor of same-sex marriage and strikes down the existing law in the early summer of 2008. And so California, you know, Massachusetts was the first state to allow same-sex couples to marry in the spring of 2004. California becomes the second 4 months later, and there's already a coalition that has formed, and basically anticipating this court decision, starts with a cluster of evangelical pastors in San Diego who make the initial push to qualify this for the ballot. The Catholic Church, starting in the San Diego Archdiocese and then San Francisco, become big institutional backers of this. They have the ability to push money to it in a way that the evangelicals can't. And then eventually the Mormons come and join it too. And what happens in California is same-sex couples start to marry in July of 2008. I think about 20,000 of them end up marrying by the time this is on the ballot in November. When Proposition 8 passes, it bans same-sex marriage in the California Constitution and takes away a right that had already been granted to couples. And this is not just a setback, obviously, for couples who are unable to marry in that window and now have this right taken away from them, but for the gay marriage movement, which had been fighting to defeat Proposition 8, this loss is far more painful than any of the other, 30 or so states where constitutional amendments had passed by referendum in previous years. And there are a few reasons for that. One, it was taking away a right that had already been awarded. So there was a real sentence. It wasn't just peremptory. But in almost all the other states, there was a real expectation that the gay marriage side was going to lose, that these amendments were going to pass from the outset. And there were sort of good structural reasons for this in almost every case. They were either in, conservative states. They took place on a ballot where, high turnout or low turnout, whatever, was going to sort of disadvantage the gay marriage side of the debate, the pro-marriage side of the debate. And there had been resource imbalances. In almost every one of these, opponents of same-sex marriage spent a lot more than supporters of same-sex marriage.
I want to jump into that because this is the point now where you get some money coming in from the business community, and in particular, you spend a lot of time with one man named Tim Gill.
Yeah, and so Tim Gill had been the founder of Quark, a desktop publishing company, and he cashed out in the late 1990s, an openly gay man who was based in Colorado, who became not just the most prominent leading single donor of gay rights and gay community work around the LGBT community work around the country, but was particularly interested in this issue of marriage when few others in the movement were, and with a circle of other large donors acting secretly, they basically helped push marriage to the top of the movement's agenda just by dint of putting so much money behind it and developing a national strategy. And so by the time this comes to the ballot in California, a lot of the infrastructure that funding had created was in place. And $45 million was spent to defeat Proposition 8. Just over 40 was spent in favor of it. So this was one of the most expensive political campaigns of any kind in American history at that point. And after it lost, after Prop 8 passed, those who had lost did not have any of their usual sort of excuses or justifications for what had happened. Not only did they have more money than their opponents, it wasn't a matter of voters sort of defaulting to the status quo, because the status quo in that case had been that gay couples were marrying in California. California was not a state like Alabama or Kentucky where there was no existing gay political infrastructure. It had, arguably the most sophisticated statewide gay political organizations in the country. The entire political leadership of the state, not just Democrats, but Republicans like Arnold Schwarzenegger, who's then the governor, opposed Proposition 8. And it was on the same ballot that Barack Obama won California by over 20 points. And Proposition 8 passes by about 4 points. And so this causes a real reckoning about gay marriage campaigners, because they come to the conclusion that they lost because they ran a bad campaign. And so the question becomes, how did we lose? Why did we lose? Who are the voters that we're failing to connect with? And what type of improvements do we have to make in our messaging and our tactics and the way we structure our campaigns so that the next time this comes to a ballot, we are better prepared than we were here?
And you dig deep into this. There's a lot of time that's spent here watching focus groups and watching ads being tested and hearing about strategies. And one of the things that struck me about one of these strategies is that, you know, there was a plan at one point that maybe if they do 10 states at a time, that eventually this could go national by 2025, and it obviously did not take that long. We've got about a minute here before we go to our first break, but what changed? What in your mind pushed things over the edge that went from that low in with Proposition 8 so quickly to full national approval?
I mean, ironically, to some degree, it was the number of states that had passed these constitutional bans, like California, made it very difficult for a sort of state-by-state incremental strategy to legalize marriage to work, because you had to get around or over these constitutional amendments, and that meant probably sooner rather than later going into federal court. And federal courts had started to look more friendly to gay rights causes than they had years earlier. But that suggested that waiting to build a sort of patchwork of states till 2025 might be tough, because the initial plan would be that you'd get to 20 or 30 states that had some form of recognition for gay couples before you launched a case, that you might just never get to that number because the amendments imposed too much of a block.
We are talking with Sasha Eisenberg, who is the author of The Engagement, America's Quarter Century Struggle Over Same-Sex Marriage, joining us from California. We're going to take our one break of the hour and hear what some prominent local Rochesterians are reading this summer, and we will be right back with more from Sasha Eisenberg on Connections. We are back on Connections. We're talking with Sasha Eisenberg, the author of The Engagement, America's Quarter Century Struggle Over Same-Sex Marriage. Joining us on this pre-recorded hour, I'm Scott Feibusch, in for Evan Dawson on Summer Book Week here on Connections. One of the things I have to kind of admit here, that when I started deciding which books to pick out to cover, that I forgot to look at how many pages were in the books that I signed up as potentially interested in requesting and reading. And I came in here one day and found 750 pages of your book waiting in my mailbox. Obviously, it's a topic that more than merits that length, and you were working on it, as we've discussed, from 2011, right up there until publication this year. Let's talk a little about the writing process, and in particular, in reading through the acknowledgments and the notes. You wrote a lot of this at sea.
Yes, I like a lot of writers, especially in the digital age, feel pressure to escape some of the distractions of my phone and the internet and TV and such. But I should note that the prospect of, like, you know, the proverbial cabin in the woods, the Thoreau thing, just scares the hell out of me. I'm a city guy. I want to be around people just enough, but not actually be distracted by them. And so at some point I kind of alighted on the idea of renting a cabin on a container ship, which I initially did. The first one, I think, was in the right at the end of December of 2013. I crossed the North Atlantic from basically Elizabeth, New Jersey, to Bremerhaven, Germany, and I spent 10 days at sea and found that I was quite productive. And then I did it again later and went across the North Pacific, went from Oakland to Busan, South Korea. That was about 16 days, as I recall. And then I did a 23-day trip from Newark, New Jersey, to Buenos Aires. And it gave me, there are people around, there are officers and crew. And so, you know, I don't feel totally alone, but I also, nothing's happening on my phone, and there's only so much you can do in a given day other than read and write.
So you got a lot of the book done that way. Was this some of this in 2013? Obviously, you were writing before you knew how this was going to end, and the end of it, as it happened, all came pretty quickly.
Yeah, you know, my initial deadline, I sold the proposal in the spring of 2012, and my initial deadline was February 2015. And so within 6 months of my starting the book, the Supreme Court said that it would hear its first marriage cases. the challenge to the Defense of Marriage Act, and then the federal challenge to California's Prop 8. And at that point, I, you know, went to my editor. I said, wow, this is already moving more quickly. We both had the same ambition for the book, which is that it would cover the – that it would be a sort of long-lasting, hopefully, account of this and not be, you know, I read a lot of, you know, quick turnaround political books, and some of them are good and some of them are bad, but very few of them last that long. And so we had the goal of making sure that this would be something which would be a kind of durable first cut at this whole history. And so we agreed that we'd push back the deadline, and then it became clear that this issue is probably going to come back to the Supreme Court rather quickly. And so by mutual understanding, we got rid of that deadline. And the idea was that, you know, I would take the time to document the what happened at the Supreme Court and what we assumed would, you know, actually become a national resolution to this, and whatever sort of fallout or backlash there was from a Supreme Court decision, and that it was worthwhile for me to take the time to deal with that in a sort of rich, complete way. And so, you know, that's part of why what I thought was going to be initially a three-year tour turned into a decade.
And you're reporting all of this out at the same time as you're working for Bloomberg Politics and writing for the Boston Globe and a whole bunch of other places. How do you strike that balance?
Yeah, you know, this was the bulk of what I did. I was a contributor to Bloomberg Politics and Business Week for a few years, and especially during the 2016 campaign. And so, you know, I was able to work out an arrangement with them where I was a contributor and they got a fraction of my time most months. And then there were some months where they got me full time in the heat of the campaign. And then there were some months where they knew that I would be out at sea. And that's also that. One thing about a container ship is it's actually just a very good way to get away from your editors. you know, they were my various sort of journalistic masters for the things I was working on during this time were really understanding from the outset that this was my big project, and that I was sort of happy to take on other things as long as I could fit it all together. And ultimately it worked out well.
How well were you able to reach all of the different players who are involved? I mean, there are a lot of players in this book. It almost needs a list of the cast of characters at the beginning of it. I was impressed. It even dug down deep enough. One of our former state senators from here, Jim Alesi, makes a brief cameo at one point as the New York State Senate all of a sudden is changing direction and approving this. And you've got that moment where he and Governor Cuomo share a little exchange on the state Senate floor. How well were you able to reach out, and were there people that you couldn't get that you wanted to get for this?
Yeah, you know, I got to speak to most of the people that I wanted to, but not all. I mean, so one of the things that's remarkable about this period in time, the book starts, as you know, in 1990 in Hawaii, and as, you know, as a journalist writing about a historical topic, I think this ends up being in a really sweet spot chronologically, which is it's just far enough in the past that a lot of individuals and institutions have given their papers to archives and libraries, and so that there is a documentary trail that isn't available if you're writing about something that, you know, happened 5 or 8 years ago, but also recent enough that almost all of the major figures are still alive and alert. And so a lot of what my reporting was, my most sort of profitable reporting was finding documents either through, you know, in archives where they're publicly accessible, or where people open up their private sort of, you know, filing cabinets or boxes in their garage or whatever it may be, and dug out documents for me. And then I could take those documents to people and who had been involved in writing them or reading them or processing them at the time, memos, you know, legal briefs, correspondence, whatever it may be, and ask, you know, get the context of what they were thinking when they received or wrote it. And, you know, that generally worked quite well. The place where I, you know, one of the things I was intent on doing from the beginning, and you know, I talk about the Mormon organizing and evangelical Protestant organizing, which is a big part of the book, reflects this, as I wanted to write as much about opponents of same-sex marriage as supporters of it. And one thing that became, you know, by the time I was deep into this in 2013 and beyond, the people who are opposed to same-sex marriage already felt like they had lost, even if they didn't know, you know, exactly how things would end at the Supreme Court in 2015. And, you know, I've never really covered sports as a reporter, but I would suspect that you know, there's a lot of pathos in the losers' locker room, but my guess is probably fewer people who are willing to dig into the minutiae of a game that they just lost than those who won. And I came to recognize that. So, you know, there were a lot of people who had played central roles in the fight against gay marriage, who had been, you know, eager to give every interview in the world in 2003, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, when they thought their cause was ascendant, sort of loved the glory of media attention, who by 2013-14 either did not want to reflect on how things had turned against them. And in many cases, I got indication were, you know, basically trying to move on and obscure their role in this. And so it was harder to get opponents of same-sex marriage to talk to me than supporters. I still got, you know, quite a few of them, including some major players who made themselves available for interviews. And I was able to, you know, I think get into places through sort of documentary records and such that, yeah, I think I can really sort of show the decision making within the LDS Church, which within a group of evangelical activists who call themselves the Arlington Group, even if some of the principal people there, by the time I got around, did not actually want to be interviewed about it.
It's Summer Book Week on Connections. I'm Scott Feibusch. In for Evan Dawson, we are talking with Sasha Eisenberg about his new book, The Engagement: America's Quarter Century Struggle Over Same-Sex Marriage. And you do, and one of the things that struck me was that you really are covering both sides of this. Was it difficult in your head? I mean, we know who won in the end. We know, because this was the whole idea that prompted you to write this, that the overall American attitude toward same-sex marriage changed in a huge way and very abruptly. Was it difficult to put yourselves in the heads of the opposing side and to be able to write fairly about what they were thinking and why they were doing what they were doing?
I don't know if it was difficult, but it's a challenge. You know, it's one of the things that sort of draws me to journalism is, you know, I wanted to not just show, you know, I wanted to explain what they believed, but people on all sides of this issue believed. I mean, one of the things that's remarkable about this topic is it comes out of nowhere, right, in Hawaii. Nobody in the United States, or hardly anybody in the United States, has a well-formed opinion about same-sex marriage before 1990. And by 1996, basically everybody in the United States has an opinion on same-sex marriage. That is really unusual in our politics. And by the mid-90s, you start to get, you know, after the Hawaii decision, you start to get that the kind of infrastructure of politics organizing it, interest groups, lobbyists, media coverage. And part of what I wanted to show was how the coalitions form around a new issue. And to do that, you sort of need to get in the heads of people at that moment. I mean, nobody in the 1990s, certainly in the early to mid-1990s, had any expectation that obviously this was going to end up at the Supreme Court within 20 years, or that this was going to become the defining, you know, gay rights issue of this period, let alone, you know, a defining sort of civil rights social movement of this time. And so to capture that for the reader, you need to understand what was going on through the minds of people on all sides of this issue. I mean, you know, and a lot of it was that they were blinkered. You know, the people in Hawaii had no idea what was going on or had gone on in other states on the mainland. People in certain state legislatures did not know what was happening in other state legislatures. Evangelical activists often did not have a lot of visibility into what the Mormons were doing. And so writing the early parts of this book to me, and sort of in researching them, reminded me a little of those sort of histories of World War One, where you see in the summer of 1914, you know, these alliances and armies sort of stumbling into a conflict, which in retrospect we obviously know becomes the Great War, but nobody obviously knows that they're getting into the Great War, and they're just making kind of tactical or strategic decisions as they go. And so, you know, what was important to me was to explain, yeah, why people thought what they did about this issue, and then what the sort of factors were that shaped their thinking about strategy and tactics and timing that ends up elevating this to the issue it became. And you know, that one of the things that was hard, not just was getting people to speak to me, it was actually less hard to get people to speak to me than to get people to be in the mindset that they had in 1994, 1998, before they knew what this would become, and remembering this before it became this sort of all-encompassing issue. That I think is a very hard mindset for any of us to, you know, remember what it was like before you had an opinion on this issue.
So that's the point, presumably, where you're going back to contemporary sources and newspaper articles and TV coverage and capturing it before people's memories have been altered, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And one thing you realize as a journalist, you know, I've been a newspaper reporter, magazine writer, and editor, as you mentioned, and the, you know, the default is thinking that the kind of gold standard of access is getting somebody who's a participant in something to give you an interview on the record about it. And, that may be true for, you know, if you're trying to make sense of why the Biden White House today did X or Y about infrastructure. But, one thing that you realize when I go into these interviews and I have a bunch of documents, I was going to say a stack of paper, but it was all on my iPad. But you have a bunch of contemporaneous documents and then you interview people about it, is you realize just how bad people's memories are about, you know, even people like lawyers where you think, you know, who have an attention to detail and, you know, are highly invested in the facts. You know, people get, you know, not just years wrong, but are sometimes off by a decade in their memory of when something happened. They get the state wrong that it was in. And, you know, without having the sort of contemporaneous paper trail, a lot of that history gets warped if you just are relying on what people remember decades later.
Which I guess is much more of a challenge if you're dealing with all these people who are still alive than a Robert Caro who just has a library to go through and memoirs of people who he'll never meet in person because they're pretty much all gone at this point.
Yeah, you know, and you know, people have conflicting memories, and you know, that's part of the challenge of this. And you know, in the hundreds of interviews I did that sort of, you know, are layered on top of the documentary work that I did. But it certainly, you know, in many respects, it makes it more complicated. Also, you know, it is just a tremendous gift to a researcher that, you know, these days, somebody like Caro, if he's going back and writing about the Johnson years, doesn't usually have this opportunity that I stumble across something, and I often was in a position where I'd already developed a sort of source relationship with the person who wrote this memo from 1997 that I just came across, or, you know, somebody had saved an email from 2001 and I get it and I can like literally text message the, you know, person who wrote it and said, you know, hey, do you remember sending this? What were you thinking at the time? And often they say, no, I hadn't seen this or thought about it in 15 years, but, you know, they look at the date and they think about what, and they say, well, I must have been intending for this and that. And that's just, something that, you know, is just for somebody trying to write history and bring context to documents that you sometimes come across cold is just a remarkable advantage to have.
You employ a narrative device that I haven't seen used as often as I would like, which is the difference between using says and said to distinguish what somebody is telling you now versus what's coming out of source material from back then. How did you land on that?
Yeah, you know, so this was a question of how to, you know, I have extensive endnotes in the book, and I credit all of the published sources that I rely on, other books, newspaper accounts, and such. But I I did a lot of interviews under sort of various conditions of journalistic confidentiality. So there are some people who talked to me off the record or did some of their interview off the record, and then people who would do some of it on background or various conditions of you can use this but not attribute it to me by name. And I wanted to find a balance between, number one, kind of journalistic attribution, and, you know, I wrote this for normal people to read, but I also hope that, you know, law schools and academic historians will find merit in it. And the simple fact is that, you know, the sort of style of journalistic attribution and the style of academic attribution and sourcing don't reconcile easily. And I was trying to figure out a way to kind of balance my, you know, objective of crediting all the work that other people, journalists, academics, historians, had done before me in this area, while also indicating what had been told to me in interviews, and it's without getting in the way of the story too much. And so the balance that I sort of came up with was use a different tense of the verb. And so my hope is that you go through, and anybody who wants to sort of figure out, did Sasha get that quote from one of his interviews, or is that from something that somebody was saying at the time, can kind of piece it together by looking at the text and then looking at the end notes. But that if you're reading it, you're not, you know, dealing with a lot of parentheticals or footnotes or, you know, journalistic terms like, as one person said, or as a source familiar with the matter recounted or something like that, that kind of, I feel like, gets in the way of following the story. So that's sort of where I ended up there. And you make some compromises in any direction if you're, I think, trying to meet all those objectives. And that's sort of where I made my set of compromises.
The book is The Engagement, America's Quarter-Century Struggle Over Same-Sex Marriage. We're talking with Sasha Eisenberg from California, joining us via Skype. We're into our final few minutes here. There are a couple of points that I wanted to get to before we run out of time here, one of which is that, you know, there's a lot of players at the absolute highest levels of this in the White House who, at least in my read, don't come off particularly sympathetically in your writing. We see Bill Clinton changing his viewpoint pretty dramatically. We see Barack Obama going back and forth over how he's going to play it. I noticed one piece that has kind of fallen into the common tale of how this happened is this idea that Joe Biden pushed Barack Obama into going all out for same-sex marriage before he was ready. And I noticed that's a piece that does not appear in your book.
Yeah, I mean, one of the big stories here is how politicians, and not just presidents, but you know, down to state legislators and members of Congress and governors, were often followers of public opinion on this issue rather than leaders of it. And, you know, one thing that really becomes clear in the Obama White House's deliberation of this is how much Obama, from the moment he first runs for the state Senate in Illinois in 1996, sort of tracks his opinion on gay marriage, almost perfectly tracks whatever the safest sort of position for the constituency that's most important to him is at the time. And so he starts running for state Senate from a, you know, sort of liberal Hyde Park district that includes the University of Chicago. And in 1996, he says that he's in favor of same-sex marriage rights. And then he later, when pressed on it, disowns it and says that it was a staffer who filled out the questionnaire for him. And then he, what happens in 2000 is that a third side sort of appears in this two-sided issue when the Vermont state legislature creates this new institution of civil unions, which allow gay couples, gay and lesbian couples, to get all of the legal rights and benefits of marriage, but without using the phrase marriage. And that becomes, throughout the 2000s, the kind of safe position for ambitious national Democrats. So that's where John Kerry is, that's where Joe Biden is, that's where Hillary Clinton is, and that's where Barack Obama is when he runs for Senate and the White House. And, you know, as he starts talking more and more about how his Christian faith shapes his views on marriage, which had never sort of been part of the conversation earlier. And it becomes clear to him by 2011, after New York, you know, I mean, I tell a story of him going to New York State. He's speaking at West Point or Fort Drum or something. And then he goes to a fundraiser, including an LGBT fundraiser for the Democratic National Committee in the summer of 2011. And he sees how ecstatic not just gay and lesbian New Yorkers are, but just generally lefty activists are about what has just happened in New York State, and the way that Governor Cuomo has been sort of lionized for his willingness to take on this issue. And Obama's advisors told me that he felt almost like left out at that point, that he saw that the kind of activist core of his party was moving to a place where he was, if not at odds with them, was behind them. And over the summer of 2011, a close circle of White House advisors, Obama basically makes clear to them, I'm ready to change my position on this issue, but you guys have to figure out the kind of timing of this. And when you're, you know, maybe when you're a county executive or something, you can change your opinion on an issue and nobody really notices it. When you're president and it's this type of issue, it was pretty clear that he would have to sort of explain to the American people what had happened. And so the question was, they decided that they should do it before he's up for re-election in November of 2012, but they didn't want to do it too late in the election year because they didn't want it to sort of overwhelm the debates and the convention. They still wanted to run against Mitt Romney on like economic issues, not about make the election about this. And so they end up settling on a plan where he's going to go do a TV interview with The View in early June of 2012, I believe. And they sort of decided in terms of the calendar and that it's best if he unveils this in an interview with a female interviewer. And that's the plan. And Biden gets asked about this. Biden's aware of that, you know, hasn't been involved in the sort of particulars of these deliberations, but is generally aware that is, you know, that Obama's going to announce a shift in this position and that it's going to happen fairly soon. And Biden gets asked on Meet the Press and says something that still to this day, if you actually read the transcript of it, it's not Joe Biden is most cogent. Let's say that. And there's actually initially a debate among Biden's own aides as to whether what he has said is different from Obama's own position on this issue. But it becomes pretty clear that the press is covering it as though Biden is now at odds with the, you know, Obama and the administration's formal position on this issue. And within 3 days, that just becomes an unsustainable contradiction. And the White House has to accelerate these plans for Obama to announce his change of position. And so he gives an interview to Robin Roberts on ABC 3 days after Biden's interview has aired on Meet the Press, in which he announces that he had changed his position.
We are nearing the end of our hour here. A couple quick questions for you before we go. Obviously, I think you lay out a very good case that this was simply an area where public opinion was moving this fast and pulling leaders along with it. If it had dragged on another year or two into the next administration past Obama and into the changes in the Supreme Court, would it have still ended up the way it did?
It's a great question, Scott. You know, I one of the things that's remarkable, I think we're going to look back at June 2015 in history books at two events that took place then. June 26th, the Supreme Court rules in Obergefell. June 15th, Donald Trump, as he likes to say, came down the escalator in Trump Tower and announced his candidacy for president. And one of the things that's remarkable is how little Trump, for all of the joy he took in basically pitting Americans against one another along various identity lines, never really took an interest in this issue. And and so I don't know whether having a different president would have changed the sort of political dynamics around this. One thing that was clear was the Supreme Court almost backed itself into a corner by the time it did take the Obergefell case, because it had let so many circuit courts strike down state bans on same-sex marriage and in many cases start allowing gay couples to marry in states, that it would have created a big mess if it had later said that those circuit courts were wrong to have done that. Because then they would have had this question of, what do you do about these, not just gay and lesbian couples who had married in those windows, but had that been fair to gay and lesbian couples who had waited not to marry in those windows? And the court, you know, for all the different ideological and doctrinal differences on the court wants to be a source of stability, and it would have been a source of chaos in American society if they had later basically said we should have heard this case earlier.
Sure. What is next for you?
I want to do a shorter project. So I think I'll do another book, but I want something that, you know, is back in the keeps me busy for 1 or 2 years framework, not necessarily the 10-year framework.
And one final question is kind of the one that's been eating at me ever since I first read excerpts of this. What else is out there? What are we maybe not seeing yet that you are, that has the potential to be the next issue like this that grabs people's attention and that changes public opinion as fast as this did? Is there anything else like that out there that you see?
I think cannabis legalization is probably the thing where we're, you know, 2/3 to 3/4 of the way through the maybe it's not a quarter century struggle, but through this arc where public opinion has moved. We basically have one party that has now come around to being completely in favor of cannabis legalization at the state level. We have one party, the Republican Party, that doesn't seem that interested in being opposed to it, even if at an individual level opinions haven't changed. And, you know, I think we have underlying it is a big generational change where the younger people are, the more accepting they are, and they basically take for granted that this is a fact of American life and that laws should catch up with it. And so I think that would be the, you know, and not dissimilar in terms of it being a very interesting intersection of state level politics, federal politics, legal changes, and, you know, and a lot of money behind the scenes driving it.
Sasha Eisenberg, thank you so much for taking some time to talk with us.
I really enjoyed it, Scott. Thank you.
Sasha Eisenberg is the author of The Engagement, America's Quarter Century Struggle Over Same-Sex Marriage, in bookstores now. He is a Washington correspondent for The Monocle, a contributor, among other things, to New York Magazine, and he joined us via Skype from California. I'm Scott Feibusch, thanking you for joining us as Summer Book Week continues on Connections. Our thanks, as always, to executive producer Megan Mack, to producer Emery Stein, and to Rob Brayton behind the console. We'll be back with more Summer Book Week tomorrow. Stay with us.